Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Altazira, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, King Charles III accedes to the throne as the UK faces a cost of living crisis. And critics are questioning the relevance of the royal family at a time of public hardship. So, how much does the monarchy cost? Also this week, Africa is likely to be the continent most affected by global warming. We speak to the Director General of the World Trade Organization to find out how commerce could be part of the climate solution. And it's dubbed quiet quitting. It's increasingly popular among young workers rethinking their work-life balance. But if it's not about people resigning from their jobs, what is it about? The British royal family is among the largest and richest monarchies in Europe, and despite the high cost of maintaining it, polls show the vast majority of Britons back the institution. Supporters say it provides a sense of unity and pride. But the UK is facing the worst cost of living crisis in decades, and critics are questioning the monarchy's expensive budget. King Charles III will take over his mother's portfolio and inherit untold riches. All eyes are now on how the royal will manage the institution known affectionately as the farm. Rory Challens reports on Queen Elizabeth II's wealth.
During the tour, the Queen, the Duke and the Prince of Wales each minted coins themselves, and the Queen kept one as a souvenir.
She famously never carried cash, despite being the face of it throughout her long reign.
My government will continue to work.
Queen Elizabeth was one of Britain's wealthiest women. A monarch, landowner, property tycoon, collector and investor, with an estimated personal fortune of about $500 million. Her own wealth came in part from her mother's estate, properties including Balmoral Castle in Scotland, a vast stamp collection, artworks and her beloved racehorses.
Done it! Estimate and Ryan Moore has won for Her Majesty the Queen!
As monarch, she owned one of the biggest property portfolios in the UK. The Crown Estate includes parks, shopping centres, offices, business and residential property. Profits from the estate, which is an independent commercial business, got paid into the UK Treasury, which in turn took 25% of the profits and paid them to the Queen. This is called the Sovereign Grant. Privately, she received money from another estate, the Duchy of Lancaster, which is held in trust for the sovereign. It's worth an estimated $682 million. The Queen started paying tax voluntarily on its income in 1992. In 2017, an investigation called the Paradise Papers found about $13 million had been invested by the Duchy legally offshore in a Caribbean tax haven.
She did nothing wrong, it wasn't illegal, but most people thought that all her investments were in Britain and they were in blue-chip companies. And it did tarnish her image of being whiter than white. It looked as though she was acting like a city fund manager.
It's unlikely we'll ever really know how wealthy the British Queen was. For some, her wealth represented an outdated institution, that of monarchy. For her supporters, though, she was a valuable asset, worth the coins and notes she appeared on.
Well, the sovereign grant cost British taxpayers more than $100 million last year. But the royal family is estimated to have cost less than $2 per British citizen. Monaco's royals are said to be the most expensive to their citizens, estimated to have received around $55 million in 2020. Out of 10 main royal families in Europe, the Principality of Liechtenstein is the only monarchy that doesn't receive any public money from the taxpayer. Only four members of Luxembourg's royal family work as full-time royals and receive public money for doing so. The royal house received almost $12 million in 2019. Many European monarchies have slimmed down in recent decades, meaning that royals are expected to find jobs and pay their own way. The Netherlands has been described as a successful example of senior members of the royal family holding down real jobs. Joining me now from London is David Haig. David is the Chief Executive Officer at consultancy firm Brand Finance. Good to have you with us, David. So Britain's economy is in turmoil, inflation rising, there's a cost of living crisis. People are finding the going tough. And yet here we've had this extravagant display of grief, a very expensive funeral. Is the British taxpayer getting value for money?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that the monarchy as a whole produces exceptionally high returns for the UK economy. We've estimated that it's at least four, if not five times what's invested, and it does it in a whole variety of different ways. And I think the second thing to take into account is that over recent years, the palace has been very, very concerned about demonstrating value for money and being transparent. And so if you actually look at what they spend the money on, it is all disclosed and very thoroughly trawled across by a variety of different people. The fact is, though, that this kind of state enterprise is expensive. Running palaces, running troops, running security is all very expensive. But in our opinion, it is worth the expenditure.
I suppose you could argue as well that even in death, Queen Elizabeth II is still working for Britain and its image. All of this pomp, circumstance, the accession of King Charles III to the throne as well, is going to bring tourists in to Britain, isn't it? They will want to come and see where all of this has happened.
Well, they've been queuing to give their respects to the Queen, and they will go on queuing right to the end, and then they will line the streets, and many, many millions of people from all over the UK. But we've been watching the interviews with people on the street, and it's amazing. They're coming from all over the world. People have come from Canada, Australia, just to pay their respects. And, you know, the monarchy, we have said for years, is a very significant incremental tourism generator. People want to come and see a living monarchy.
The king himself is a wealthy man, thanks in part to the Duchy of Cornwall, which will, of course, now pass to the Prince of Wales. And is it right, do you think, that the royal family have private sources of income, which are not exactly private sources of income, in that much of the money is actually handed to the state?
Well, I think you could draw a comparison with presidents of the USA. Presidents of the USA have their own private wealth, and they make it before they get into office, and they make it after they get into office. The king or queen is really the head of state and the representative, so it's an equivalent of a president. And one has to distinguish between the private finances of those individuals and the state finances. In the absolute scale of things, the royal family, you know, on a global level and compared with all the many billionaires there are in the world, the royal family is not that wealthy. They are very wealthy people by our standards, but on a global level, they are not. It's probably measured in the tens of millions. Whereas the money which is invested in the monarchy by the country and is owned by the country, so all the palaces and all the collections and all of that sort of thing is owned by the country, that runs to billions, but it belongs to the country, and I think that's the most important thing.
The Principality of Liechtenstein, as we were hearing a few moments ago, doesn't receive any public money from the taxpayer, and many monarchies rely upon their own riches to do the job of being their country's representative, if you like. Does public funding of the monarchy in the UK, given what's going on economically, still make sense?
Well, I think if it weren't demonstrably making a return to the UK, then it probably wouldn't be worth it. But the fact is, it demonstrably does make a big return to the UK, not least, for example, in the amount of free publicity and coverage that is favourable to our soft power. You know, if you were to go around the world and ask who is the king, prince, ruler of Liechtenstein, I doubt you would find anyone in the world who would even know. And I also doubt you would find anyone who knows anything about Liechtenstein. So, you know, they may not be paying them, but they're not getting much back. Whereas here in the UK, our monarchy is making us one of the world's leading soft power countries. And for the money spent, we get a great deal of return.
How mindful, though, do you think King Charles is of the criticism that the royal family gets as far as its expenditure is concerned? Do you think that he will continue with this this desire to be seen, at least, to be slimming down? Are we going to see more royals expected to pay their way, perhaps, by getting proper jobs?
Well, one could argue it is a proper job. You know, the working royals do a great deal of good for charity, for institutions in the UK and the Commonwealth and all over the world. And it's a very important job and a very tough job, if you ask me. Only a small number of the royals are actually working royals. They are the only ones that actually get paid money by the state. The rest of the royal family do have to go out and make their own living. They have to be very discreet about the way they do it. But turning to Prince Charles, I think he's a very sensitive man. He's an extremely sensitive man, and he's an extremely intelligent man. And he has been saying for years that the institution of monarchy in the UK needs to be very transparent. It needs to demonstrate that what it's doing is, you know, it's not extravagant and that it produces a return. I am sure he will continue to do that.
So as far as you're concerned, David, Brand Windsor, the royal family in the UK, provides excellent value for money.
Well, we've been saying since 2011, when William and Kate got married, right through the Jubilee and through the Meghan and Harry wedding, that the royal family definitely produces a huge return for the UK, and you can broadly put it into three chunks. One is tourism and trade, where they're very, very favourable indeed. One is in terms of the effect that it has on royal warrants. And thirdly, it's just a general goodwill and stability factor that increases the wealth of the country. And, you know, one very good expression of that is the patronage of the royal family for brands via the royal warrant system, which generates a great deal of economic wealth for more than 800 companies. So, yes, I think it's extremely good value for money.
David, really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you.
Africa emits only around 3% of global gas emissions, and yet African nations are among those most exposed to the impact of climate change. At least 20 million people are at risk of severe hunger because of East Africa's worst drought in a generation. The World Trade Organization says that trade can help the continent tackle global warming. Al Jazeera's Rasul Serdar spoke to the Director General of the WTO, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, at the African Adaptation Summit in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands.
Actually, we don't have to look too far to see the impact of climate change on trade. We saw this summer how rivers in Europe that normally have barges that carry goods, like the Rhine, the Danube, beginning to dry up and it making it difficult for barges to carry goods, and then they have to be put on trucks and trains, which is far more expensive. So climate change is meaning that we might see the cost of trade going up because of shipping and transshipment issues. So that's one side of the equation. Now, on the other side that people don't think about is that trade is really part of the solution to climate change. Trade is itself an instrument of adaptation. Just think about this. Without trade, you will not be able to make available the new technologies that will help for climate adaptation. You will not be able to have access to the goods and services to take good practices from one country to the other. All this is facilitated by trade. So trade is centrally important. It's also an instrument of adaptation because if you have a climate event that makes it impossible for you to grow your food, or that inundates, properties and so on, you need to have access, perhaps to externally, to other countries to be able to bring in food, bring in supplies, bring in equipment that you need.
Well, agriculture is among the sectors most at risk, with some studies estimating that climate impacts could cut the continent's crop productivity growth by a third. The WTO says that Africa's trade could help offset future shocks in agricultural output.
Africa's share of world trade, of global merchandise trade, is very low. It's less than 3%. This has to change. If Africa is to benefit from world trade and from the rules of the World Trade Organization, we need to trade more. So that means we shouldn't just be trading raw materials and commodities as we've done year after year. It means we need to start adding value to our products. I'd like to see Africa's share of world trade double within the next decade. We should be doing up to 6% of world trade. To do that, we must add value to our products. We must attract supply chains. You know, the world is starting to see that we need to diversify our supply chains because of what happened during the pandemic, when we saw that goods, manufacture of certain goods, is concentrated in a few countries, and that's risky. That diversification, we can take advantage of it to bring those supply chains to Africa. So we're also part of the global value chains. And I call it re-globalization. Let's use trade to re-globalize the world and bring Africa into the mainstream of the trading system.
Well, Okonjo-Iweala says that ensuring access to new technologies is important to helping Africa reduce the climate impact.
We managed to get a compromise agreement at the WTO that is enabling developing countries to have access to vaccine patents using instruments that can override these for the next 5 years. I am sincerely hoping that with climate change, the ravages of climate change, which will mean that we will not, sometimes food, we may not be able to grow food, we may need new technologies on the continent to help us have drought-resistant varieties, flood-resistant varieties, new technologies, as you said. I'm hoping that, knowing that we are all in this together, that we need global solidarity, we will be able to come to sensible arrangements whereby Africa and those parts of the developing world that need new technologies can access it, whilst at the same time not disincentivizing those who want to create new technologies and do research.
Well, wealthy nations pledged to spend around $25 billion by 2025 to help Africa adapt to climate change. The World Trade Organization says that financing should be aligned with trade policies.
Africa needs a just transition. So it needs to be given time to be able to transition to the new technologies, to renewables. It's beginning to happen, but during this period, we need to look at other fuels, not the maybe the worst of the fossil fuels like coal, but gas as a transition fuel is now being increasingly recognized so that the country can have baseload power that can, you know, sort of power manufacturing on the continent and help us develop. Developed countries promised $100 billion to go with the Paris Accords. We now understand that we're approaching 80. We hope that by the time we get to COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, we'll know we're 100. But that's just the beginning. We need more resources from both public and private sector. Now, for the WTO, what can we do? Let me tell you this. Sometimes you can have money and financing, but you're still not able to access the goods you need to transition. We've seen it in the pandemic. There were those who had resources. COVAX had money to purchase vaccines for Africa. But because of export restrictions, COVAX was not able to get those vaccines out of India at the time they were needed. So we want our members to make sure that for the green transition, we should look at how to keep prohibitions and restrictions down on green goods, on technologies that are needed, so that those developing countries, including countries in Africa who need access, can have it.
Now, millions of workers around the world lost their jobs during the pandemic. Others were forced to work from home. And that's provided an opportunity for many employees to rethink their career choices, reimagine the workplace, and try to take back their power at work. For example, more than 70 million American workers left their jobs in the year starting April 2021 in what was known as the Great Resignation. Now, another trend is on the rise. It's called quiet quitting. And despite the name, it has nothing to do with people actually resigning from their jobs. Well, the term describes workers who only do the job that they're being paid to do, just meeting their job description without taking on any extra duties in order to focus on time spent outside the office. It's become a buzzword recently after Ziad Khan, an American TikTok user with over 10,000 followers, posted a video that went viral saying, "Work is not your life." According to a survey by Gallup, including 15,000 full and part-time workers, about half of American workers are quiet quitters. Another term is also increasingly becoming part of the workplace debate. It's quiet firing. Now, that defines employers who make working conditions so miserable or deny resources or opportunity to workers, aiming to force employees to leave without dismissing them outright. Well, to discuss all of this, we're joined by Chris Warhurst. Chris is the director of the Institute for Employment Research at the University of Warwick. He joins us now from Glasgow in the UK. Good to have you with us, Chris. The fact that some employees feel unmotivated, the drudge of the 9 to 5, not engaged with their jobs, is nothing new. People have always felt like that. So why the fuss over quiet quitting?
All jobs consist of a bundle of tasks, and these tasks are very loosely defined. You know, it's to serve customers or to drive a train, and we never have the detail about how you're supposed to do that. And many people add discretionary effort. They go the extra mile. You know, they chat to customers when they're serving them so that the customers feel good and come back. Or they, in the case of train drivers in the UK at the moment, if somebody's off sick, they'll come in and work an extra day. And all that helps companies be more efficient and work smoothly. And quiet quitting means withdrawing some of that discretionary effort and doing the minimum specified in the contract. And they don't tell bosses that they're doing it. Hence, it's a silent withdrawal of labour and goodwill. And I think there's a couple of reasons why this might be happening and happening now. Because as you say, it's nothing new particularly. I mean, in the 1970s, people used to do something called work to rule when they were in dispute with management. And that meant, again, that they worked simply to what was in their contract and nothing more. And everything suddenly started to collapse. Trains didn't run properly, schools weren't working properly, cars weren't being made properly because people were doing only the minimum. But the difference was then, the old days, that this was done collectively and openly. And now it's been done quietly and on an individual basis. We don't, of course, know the extent of it because nobody collects data on it because it is a silent phenomena. But I think some people link it to the pandemic and say, for a lot of workers during the pandemic, they were working at home. And working at home meant the bosses weren't around, they had a lot of discretion about how they worked. And now that they're being called into the offices and being called into offices at the time when they actually know they can do the jobs at home, they're feeling less inclined. They kind of have less of that discretion, and that makes them a bit unhappy. So they're losing control over the work.
You say, Chris, that there are no studies into how widespread this practice has become. But the fact that it started on social media, I suppose, means that at least we consume, as far as the demographics are concerned, this is involving younger as opposed to more senior, experienced workers. Would that be a correct assumption, do you think?
We're finding these anecdotes popping up on social media and places like TikTok, and that does reflect the demographic. And those younger workers, if it is those younger workers that are reporting this, they're the ones who are less committed to workplaces because they're at the start of their careers, and of course they don't have mortgages and they don't have families. So they feel more able, if you like, to be able to do that silent withdrawal. And many of them, of course, younger workers, are not organised through trade unions. So in many ways, they're not able to take that collective action that was done in the past.
So how should employers deal with quiet quitting? I mean, the obvious answer should be pay them more.
Well, I think employers need to take a step back and say, look, workers putting in this discretionary effort helps their businesses run more efficiently and more smoothly. And if workers are quietly quitting, they're losing that extra effort and extra reward. And so they've got to take a step back and say, OK, what will happen next? It's likely that these employees will leave in the future. I mean, dissatisfied employers tend to leave organisations. That will lead to more labour shortages. That leads to less efficiency in their organisation. So things won't run smoothly. The lesson, I think, as you rightly say, is that they've got to treat employees well. I mean, that means not expecting them to work long hours in the evenings to do extra tasks, and it means paying them decent wages or paying them fairly, what employees think is a fair wage for what they're doing. And, of course, the context to all of this is there are labour shortages at the moment, and because firms are not recruiting as many people as they would like, there's more work for the existing employees. So there's a lot of kind of compounding factors here, and employers have to kind of take a step back and say, we need to keep the employees that we've got, treat them fairly.
So what about the issue of quiet firing? Why would a boss resort to doing that? Or is it as a direct response to quiet quitting?
Just like quiet quitting, in its own way, quiet firing has been around for a long time. Employers or managers, if they were unhappy with individual workers, would marginalise them. And again, it's a difficult situation for both employees and employers and the managers, because nobody wants recalcitrant workers that don't do what they're doing. But it's really managers taking a step back and saying, well, why is it that these employees are not doing what we want them to do? Why is it that they feel unhappy in the workplace? So in one sense, quiet firing looks like the obvious response to quiet quitting, but neither party really benefits from it.
Chris, it's been really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us. And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything that you've seen, you can tweet me. I'm at Dave Finnegan on Twitter. Use the hashtag AJCTC if you can. Or you could drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page, and there you'll find individual reports, links, even entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan. From the whole team here in Doha, thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.